Now, among the stories making headlines this past week was the sad news that the world's last male northern white rhino had died. Sudan, as he was named, died on Monday in Kenya, aged 45. There are now two surviving female northern white rhinos left in the world, Sudan's daughter and granddaughter, neither of whom have been able to breed successfully. Before his death, significant efforts were made to raise $10 million for fertility programs for rhinos. As ever more species are added to the list of endangered animals, some scientists argue we have to make some tough decisions on which species we're willing to fight for and which we're content to let die out. They call it species triage, using economic and mathematical modelling to decide where best to spend the limited conservationist dollar. Professor Hugh Possingham is a pioneer in this area, having developed the widely used planning software Marxan, which is used to design conservation zones with the best chance of success. He's the chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy, the world's largest environmental non-government organisation. From Vancouver, welcome to Sunday Extra, Professor Possingham.
Hi, Hugh.
Good morning. Good morning indeed. Good evening, I presume, where you are. Now, the northern white rhino, the last male has gone. Presumably, this animal or this subspecies as a genetically distinct subspecies is gone, regardless of whatever surrogacy or IVF trickery might still be available to the two females who are left.
Oh, well, sort of not quite true. I mean, we've done remarkable things in the past. The Norfolk Island Bulbocana was taken back from one individual. And the dusky seed-sized sparrow was taken back from one individual, and that's done through crossbreeding with their related cousin, their related subspecies. So in some senses, you can back create more or less what would look like a northern white rhino by using the southern white rhinos. The question, of course, then is it worthwhile? I mean, other options are, for example, is taking the southern white rhinos, who have been doing very well in southern Africa over the last 20 years. They're still under a lot of pressure, and just putting them back where the northern white rhinos were. So there are some options. And, of course, because it's only a subspecies, the options are much broader than if it was just on its own and there was no related species nearby.
So if you talk about that, the concept of a subspecies, yes, it would be, you know, to a passing, you know, person with their long lens camera, it looks like the same rhino. But in strict scientific terms, are we essentially developing a new subspecies, given that it's no longer purely a northern white rhino?
Exactly. And obviously different subspecies of the same species can interbreed. So in that sense, the loss of a subspecies is not as dramatic as the loss of a species. If you lost also the southern white rhino, then we will never get any sort of white rhino back again unless we do a lot of even more complicated genetic modifications and recreate the species. And that becomes, of course, even more expensive. So, right, it's not so dramatic. Yep.
So from the perspective of money spent and value delivered, is there too much money being spent on the effort to try to keep, you know, some sort of remnant part of the northern white rhinos alive through these processes?
Yeah, so I'm going to deliberately dodge the question, Hugh, because I don't want to give a yes-no answer to it. But, I mean, some of the factors to play here are this. Rhinos are pretty incredible things. There are five rhino species on the planet. None of them are doing very well. The Javan rhinoceros, 63 individuals in Western Java. They're iconic things. They're in advertisements. If children have plastic toys, one of their plastic toys will be a rhinoceros. So they're not really like the thousands of species that are threatened around the world, and which there are thousands of species. They're not another small brown bird. So in that sense, they're so culturally significant, and one would argue that even though this is only a subspecies, and maybe it's going to cost tens of millions of dollars, there's enough interest from very wealthy people and big organisations, and of course the governments where those things live. I mean, to countries like Sudan and Congo and Uganda, which once harboured the northern white rhinoceros, the prospect of getting them back into the ecosystem and having tourists come to look at them, these animals potentially can make countries a lot of money. So in that sense, they're a bit different from many of the other species we're talking about, which, other than to a very specialised bird watcher, nobody ever wants to see.
So, I mean, we know that it's not just those little brown birds that might be threatened, but also countless thousands of very uninteresting insects and things like that, which are threatened. So what's your argument then with triage?
I think with triage generally, particularly countries like Africa, countries like Australia, like Brazil, which are mega diverse countries, we are losing species now at an enormous rate. Australia's lost two mammal species in the last 10 years. Indonesia, the most biodiverse country in the entire planet, has a long list of threatened species, many of which have no recovery plan, no action, very little habitat protection. So from the perspective of an organisation like the Nature Conservancy, who's trying to operate globally to save the greatest number of species for the greatest good and create functioning ecosystems, yeah, we would not spend $10, $20, $50 million trying to resurrect a subspecies of a particular mammal. That would not be our approach. We would say that for that amount of resource, we could protect large areas of, say, central Kalimantan, which has enormous diversity. In doing so, we're protecting long-term functioning ecosystems with, as you say, those thousands of insects.
So how do you spend that money?
Knows the name of.
So is that about actually just protecting the botanical biodiversity? Is that the key?
It is the forest and also managing it well, and sometimes it may be doing deals with the sustainable logging industry. Maybe we are allowing use by local people. So it's always done in cooperation with the people in place. Try to be a sustainable financing model where they may be getting carbon credits or tourism dollars or using the forest. But in the end, you know, as the koala people say, no tree, no me. Habitat's the core. The vast majority of species that have gone extinct in the last 100 years have gone extinct because of habitat loss. The quality and quantity of habitat is everything to conservation. And again, for remarkably small amounts of money, you can still secure very large areas of habitat in many countries, and including Australia. And so organisations like Bush Heritage Australia are doing this extremely well.
So this is not a new idea from you. You first put it to the government 20-odd years ago. What has been the response?
Well, New Zealand have picked up the whole prioritisation process, and they again have over 1,000 threatened species, and now they're using our basically mathematical formula that tries to save the most species for the resources they have. So it's very much the greatest good. New South Wales have a Save Our Species program, and again, they're focusing their attention on not just the things that people in the past thought were interesting or they wanted to study because they were their favourite species. They're really focusing on saving as many species as possible in the state of New South Wales. And that's actually enabled them to raise more money because, you know, if conservation has a business plan, then to me it becomes much more appealing for governments and the private sector to invest in that business plan. If somebody said to you, here's the business, I'm opening a restaurant chain, I want to maximise the benefits per dollar, you'd say, good. If they said, oh, I just want to serve masaka, masaka doesn't make me any money, but I just like serving it, you wouldn't be that impressed. So I think it's just bringing economic rationalism to the world of conservation.
So if part of it is that habitat, saving habitat, that plainly is central to the argument, what about the factor of feral animals? If we look at the Australian example, we hear horrendous statistics about the capacity, for example, of feral cats alone to destroy huge numbers of native animals. Is that a cost-effective use of funds, is to go out and try and wipe out feral cats, for example?
In some places, it definitely is. And so, for example, a good example is on Macquarie Island, where not only did they remove the cats and the rabbits, now they've got the rodents down as well. And that's caused, and this is the government of Tasmania and other organisations in the federal government, enormous rebounding of a large number of seabird species. So we're really seeing the recovery of things that were once very threatened. So, yeah, on contained places like that, inside fences and on islands, the destruction of feral mammals, placental mammals in Australia, is a cost-effective action. Australia is unusual. in the sense that in general, ferals are not the primary, invasives are not the primary cause of extinction. Australia sort of behaves a bit like a Pacific island. Well, it's sort of a Pacific island, just a very big one, very, very big Pacific island, where most of the extinctions are, as you say, largely caused by the introduction of rats, pigs, goats, cats to those islands. And yes, it's all again, which island, which species do you get rid of, and what sort of interesting things can you save by investing in those islands? So there's whole organisations like Island Conservation who target cost-effective decision-making on eradicating pests and delivering the biggest biodiversity benefit using the same sort of thinking.
So the essence of triage, if I've got it correctly, is that you divide everything up into three. You say it doesn't matter how much effort we put into this, it's going to die out anyway. You can say, well, all these other ones on the other side of the scale, we don't need to put any effort into that one because it's going to survive anyway. So you're only focusing such resources as you've got on those who will be saved only if they get that resource directed towards them. Which then goes to the question of the resource itself. How is, let's start with Australia, but there's obviously a global implication as well. How is Australia in terms of having the resources available to do the work you think needs to be done to save species?
Well, Australia's a bit like Peru and Indonesia and Brazil. We're not doing very well. So there are a very small number of countries who seem to have stabilised their biodiversity loss. A lot of Europe and arguably they lost a lot in the past and they haven't got much to stabilise. The United States, the investment in threatened species and the power of their legislation, their Endangered Species Act, is enough to now appear to have stabilised species loss. But of course, Australia's economy is just a little bit less than the United States. We have more biodiversity than the United States. So our task is something like 20 to 100 times bigger, which is why we have to adopt what you just said. I prefer to call it, I suppose, prioritisation. It's a sort of a scientist / economist strategic advisor. All I can do is give people the ranked list of where they get the biggest return on investment for the actions they take, for which species are going to be most likely to save, which are cheapest and which are most important to ecosystems. The actual final decision about how much society chooses to spend on saving species, sadly, is out of my hands. And so in some senses, I do prioritisation. The NGO sector has to have ranked, ordered, rational lists of how it invests. It's the governments and the donors who, and the society of the world who actually has decided how much we're willing to spend on conservation. And it's not very much. It's about 10% of what we really need. If we really want to be serious about stopping species loss globally, we'd have to reinvest. We'd have to multiply our investments in conservation tenfold through the private sector
and through governments. Let's assume for the moment, I don't want to absolutely assume it, but for the sense of this argument, let's assume that you're not going to get a sudden flood of money. Let's hope you do. What species, let's say, in Australia, are you willing to say, we can't help you, you're just going to have to die out?
Yeah, well, we're already doing that. So in sense, it's not... Let's take the New Zealand example where they are using prioritisation. Before they used prioritisation, they were working on 130 species, 135 species. Having taken our scientific work and our economic work and reordered the list, they now work on over 400 species. They're not working on 200 or 300, but they're working on 2.5 times as many as they were before they did the prioritisation.
So when you say working, that means these are the ones that are actively trying to save.
Recovering. Exactly. They're stabilising and trying to recover.
And in order to do that, how many have they had just cast away?
Well, they were casting away around 600 or 700. Now they're casting... Well, they're not casting away. They don't go and shoot them, obviously, or just stomp on them. They just haven't got the time and money to invest in them. And yes, 200 or 300, they would admit that at the present point in time, they can't invest in. And the same's true for Australia. We're already not investing in many threatened species. We're not investing enough. That's not the decision of the prioritiser. That's the decision of the listeners of Radio National who vote in governments who underinvest in conservation.
Okay, so people listening, it's down to you on that business of those who decide that you're going to triage out, that you're not going to put more effort in. Are there any sort of postcard type of species in there that that people might have heard of where... You've said, you know what? That's within Australia?
Probably not, because most of the postcard ones have a big following of their own and they get some private investment. The group of species I genuinely love are Australia's terrestrial orchids. We have something like 1,000 species of them. In places like Victoria alone, there's 20 or 30 that are on the brink of extinction. And these are spectacular plants. They're unusual. They're very hard to grow in your garden or in captivity or botanic gardens. Their ecology is fascinating. They're often pollinated by wasps who think they're having sex with the plant, and that's how the pollination occurs. They're diverse. They're interesting, and they make up about 20% of our threatened plants, and we have about 1,000 threatened plants. So we're talking about 200 species of terrestrial orchid, where I think the investment is negligible.
Well, my orchid-loving wife would love to hear you say that. Good. Professor Hugh Possingham, thank you so much for joining us on discussing triaging to save as many of these species as we can. Hugh Possingham is Chief Scientist at the Nature Conservancy. This is Radio National.